you, Femi.
You're welcome.
So some people cautiously say never, but not Barack Obama.
The United States is not and will never be at war with Islam.
That was the president speaking in Turkey earlier this month. Now, the world can get smaller as world population increases, the world of borders and nations. But ideologies and principles of religion as a motive for war and terrorism don't necessarily shrink. At the beginning of this century, they seem to be expanding in some sense. Joining us now is Reza Aslan, author of How to Win a Cosmic War, God, Globalization, and the End of the War on Terror. How's that for a book title? He's right here in the studio with us. Reza Aslan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, at the beginning of the 20th century, there were a lot of people who wrote that the globally interlocked economy, and it was fairly globally interlocked back then, meant that there could not possibly be a world war. And then in 1914, boom, Europe stumbled into the most devastating conflict up to that time, and we've had a couple since. Why is globalization, and is globalization, any sort of insurance policy against a global, as you say, cosmic war over religion or ideology in this century?
Well, it may sound ironic, but in a way, you know, the great world wars of the 20th century had partly to do as sort of the inevitable consequences of nationalism. And in a sense, what globalization is doing as it's kind of fading away the borders and boundaries that used to sort of keep us as these kind of homogenous, sovereign nation states is that nationalism is no longer the primary marker of identity in large parts of the world, even in some sense here in the United States, where we still have a very strong sense of national identity. And I think as that starts to slip away, as people no longer begin to define themselves primarily in terms of their national identity, they're going to start going back to sort of more primal forms of identity, like ethnicity and like religion, but especially religion, because in a sense, religion has always been that sort of initial, you know, force of globalization.
So that sounds like backsliding. That doesn't sound like moving forward towards an era of world harmony.
It depends. If you think of, you know, the end of the 19th and 20th century and the rise of secular nationalism as sort of showing, you know, the progress of humanity, then yes, it does seem like backsliding. But in a sense, some people would argue that part of the reason why people are becoming more religious or identifying themselves more, you know, in terms of religion is that in a way, secular nationalism kind of failed in the promises that it made. As you mentioned, these promises of global peace and security. The truth of the matter is the last century has been by far the bloodiest, most bestial century in human history.
Let me focus on what you talk about in your book. And I think there's a temptation sometimes to organize things democratically in the sense that if 51% of the people sign on to something, therefore it's going to move populations. And I'm wondering if there's an alternative view here. A lot of people may not act on the basis of their religion, but virtually anyone is capable of being insulted or offended based on somebody else's insult to their religion. So I'm wondering if a small group of individuals can actually motivate huge global changes to take place. It doesn't take a nation of suicide bombers to produce the war on terror. All it takes is 19 people in planes to produce the war on terror. So in that calculus, very few people can have enormous impacts. Don't you agree?
No question. But let's step back just for a moment here because, you know, in the United States, we have this tendency to think of religion as though it's some kind of personal confessional experience. And the truth is that's not really how religion functions in most of the world, including here in the U.S. Religion for most people is a form of identity. It's about who we are as human beings. It's about our place and our sense of self in an indeterminate world. When almost 80% of Americans call themselves Christian, I mean, the truth is that 80% of Americans don't go to church every Sunday. 80% of Americans don't read, you know, the Bible. 80% of Americans probably can barely tell you who Jesus was.
Yeah, but six, you know, 19 guys show up and blow up a building in New York, and 80% of Americans believe they're involved in some sort of holy war.
Exactly. No, there's no question that extremism and radicalism is almost by definition always a minority movement, but it always is the loudest voice.
So you write How to Win a Cosmic War, but I'm wondering if a better question is, how do we avoid stumbling into a cosmic war?
Well,
you just
gave away the end of the book. Now you don't have to pay the $25 to. No, the truth is, look, a cosmic war is a war in which participants believe that they are acting out on Earth a battle that's actually taking place in heaven between the forces of good and evil. And the argument of the book is that the Al-Qaeda and these like-minded, you know, militants that associate themselves with the jihadist movement are fighting a cosmic war, a war of their imagination, that their goals, their ideologies, their agendas are ridiculous, impossible to achieve in this life, which is, by the way, why they never talk about it. And unfortunately, what we have done by adopting the same religiously polarizing language, by adopting the same cosmic worldview, is that we are also fighting a cosmic war. And as you rightly say, there's no winning a cosmic war. You can't win something like
this. Well, on this getting the imagined cosmic warriors down to earth, how do you rate the rhetoric of Barack Obama in the early going? Do you think it's a good approach?
I do think it's a very good approach. Look, I mean, look, if we are engaged in a war of ideology, as we've been constantly told that we are, then obviously our words can become our most important and most effective weapons. And I think what's great about Obama is that he understands this. He recognizes that words matter. Your rhetoric matters. And the fact that we have now, it seems, joined the rest of our European allies and given up this war on terror, you know, rhetoric, which in and of itself is so deeply infused with this religious, cosmic, you know, war sense, is a good start.
Well, it's a great point that you make, and we'll have to leave it there. But in a war of imagination and ideology, it's the words that really matter more than the weapons. And so the rhetoric is actually more important. We think of it so surfacey, but in fact, as you argue here, it's maybe more crucial and more central to the whole issue of whether there's a cosmic war or not. Reza Aslan, thanks so much for being with us.
I was just going to say, isn't it also the words that the leaders are putting in people's minds?
Indeed. Indeed.
No question.
And the imagination is where it all works out. Reza Aslan is the author of How to Win a Cosmic War, God, Globalization, and the End of the War on Terror. Thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So it's Earth Day today, right, Lynn?
All day today it is Earth Day. So we want to know, what's the one poison you still won't give up?
My name is Andy Mims, calling from Boston. And I can't give up taking longer showers in the morning than I should.
You asked what I have not given up. Having children. It's so much fun, and it's the ultimate pollutant. If we each have only four children, we can double the population in one generation.
I have four.
And John's there. We also want you to do a little experiment for us. Go to your cupboard, take out an item, and fill in the blanks. I was surprised to find blank in my blank.
We've already found sugar in salt.
And cheese in Velveeta.
That's right. Yeah, who would have thought?
So call with your poisons and the ones you didn't know about in your cupboard at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And here's your takeaway.
The real problem with young people is that they get inculcated into this culture of debt. And given that you're already borrowing $20,000 to go to school, it seems normal to sign up for a campus credit card.
Fee harvesters and other horror stories from the credit card world. That's Anya Kamenetz, staff writer of Fast Company magazine and author of Generation Debt. You can hear that interview online if you go to our podcast at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Lynn Scherr.
This is The Takeaway.